maybe it needs a negative. Maybe it needs to think about the fact that you don't have a diverse decision-making circle as a weakness, as a threat. So I think we have to get much more serious about the cultures of innovation. And from the American perspective, innovation means being the first and being the best. And that is not the Russian approach to innovation.
Welcome to the Convergence, Army's Mad Scientist Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Shabro, Deputy Director of the Army Mad Scientist Initiative, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Sanisper, of the Combat Capabilities Development Command's Armament Center within the Army's Futures Command. On today's episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Margarita Konaev, Research Fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Dr. Konaev has written extensively on issues ranging from Russia to unmanned combat vehicles to urban warfare.
The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or Training and Doctrine Command.
So we're excited today to be joined by Dr. Margarita Konaev.
You have such an interesting background. So can you really tell the people listening here what led you down that path of research that you've been on?
Of course, I'm nodding. Thank you, first of all, for having me here today. I'm really excited to have this conversation and to learn from you guys and, hopefully have an interesting discussion for our audience. In terms of my background, I think a lot of us in international security or national security, whether it's from an academic perspective or as practitioners, come to it for some personal reason, one way or another. And for me, I guess it goes back to the fact that I was born in Uzbekistan when it was still part of the Soviet Union. And after it collapsed, my family moved to Israel in 1995 when I was 9 years old, and that's where I grew up. So you can say in a sense that I have some sort of a personal experience with state collapse, armed conflict, terrorism, all the bleak, terrible stuff that we study and are involved in. So in
all,
a way,
all the childhood memories everybody wants.
All the lovely stuff. So in a way, I guess I was preordained to study international security. And in terms of like my focus on urban warfare, that's even more infuriating in some sense. I was writing my dissertation on the settlement and the resolution of armed conflicts over national self-determination. And my two cases, as you might be able to guess, were the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Russia, the Russian and Chechen conflict in the 90s. And I was doing the PhD in political science, and my focus was on civil wars and conflict processes. And as I was reading through that literature that tends to focus predominantly on rural conflicts and guerrilla warfare, I was just astounded by the fact that this body of work that knows so much about why people engage in violence, why they mobilize politically, why they, you know, take on arms, how armed groups operate, you know, different dynamics and networks, all of this stuff about armed conflict just completely either fundamentally misunderstood or just ignored urban conflicts and urban warfare. So I was really dumbfounded in the sense that this area of expertise that I was delving into and trying to become an expert in really had not much at all to say about this topic that is increasingly more and more important as the world urbanizes and we're seeing just more frequency of violence in urban settings. So I don't know if anybody else shares the anger as a motivator feeling, but that kind of was what initially led me down the path of studying urban warfare. And, you know, even within that, I've kind of been a skeptic about the role of technology in helping us resolve some of the problems that, you know, militaries have faced in urban settings for generations and decades and through different countries and whatnot. But now being at CSET and having the opportunity to explore artificial intelligence and its role and implications for national security, I'm definitely learning a lot. So my thinking there is still at kind of its formative stages. So it's nice to be able to change your mind a little bit here and there.
So you brought up urban warfare, mm-hmm. and you brought up your skepticism about technology being able to solve certain problems. Mm-hmm. Do you think that urban warfare and the rise of urban warfare is going to necessitate more robotics and autonomy? And if so, in what ways?
I would say that we need to be realistic about what robotics and autonomy and AI can do for us in urban environments. Because as I said, there are challenges there that are just not amiable to technological solutions. So I think like the Army's robotics and autonomous systems strategy gets a lot of things right. It gets right the role that, you know, these technologies can play in increasing situational awareness in information-saturated environments. The ability to, you know, analyze massive amounts of information and distill it to actionable, immediately useful, concrete intelligence, and the help that, you know, AI can provide with better wartime decision-making. All of these are crucial. I think they can be quite central. And in terms of, you know, kind of removing some of the cognitive and the physical burden, absolutely robotics and AI can play an important role. But at the same time, there are a few areas that I think that are over-reliance on technology in general, and especially in urban settings, is kind of to our detriment. And one of those areas, I think, is the role of precision weaponry in general and how we think about their use in densely populated urban settings. So we tend to think about the use of precision strikes kind of on an individual basis. So every time you get a precision strike, it's very obviously accurate. And when it's in, when it's evaluated individually, it doesn't seem to be, it's causing a much more limited amount of collateral damage and civilian harm than otherwise like a dumb bomb would cause. But we can't think about these strikes individually. We have to think about their cumulative effect. So if you keep striking a small, very densely populated area, even if you're doing it extremely accurately in a very contained measure, it all adds together. So the many repeated uses of precision technology and precision strikes in densely populated urban areas, the cumulative effect, when you calculate it all together, you are dealing essentially with much of the same effects that a dumb bomb would have. So this is something that is referred to by people as a precision fallacy or a precision paradox. So as our systems become smarter and our weapons become more accurate, I'm not necessarily sure that we in any way overcome that problem. I think that problem might become even worse because we just become more reliant on this technology because it does make sense to use it. And the second area, I mean, I don't need to tell you guys that there's a lot of money being poured into right now into unmanned ground vehicles. And whether they're armed or potentially armed, manned or potentially manned, there are a lot of technical challenges there that I'm not fully convinced are overcomable, whether it comes to like ground navigation or communications in these environments. And giving them greater autonomy, especially with the ability to target, identify targets and eventually engage targets, because there is the temptation because they can they have greater access and greater persistence. I'm somewhat worried about them being able to operate in communications in night environments. So those are two areas that I think I'm most skeptical about at this point.
Yeah, I think that brings us an interesting point, especially when you talk about the accumulation of effects by that precision. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Raqqa, okay, so tons of PGM strikes, but in the end, it still ends up a devastated city that's pretty uninhabitable in a lot of places. So I think that's such an interesting point. You have, you know, we talked about your background a little bit, and you have, I think, with the unique approach you have because of your background, you have a better understanding probably of more of an Eastern mindset than what, you know, Western thinkers have. We have all this expertise throughout the military and in the defense complex and all these great thinkers at think tanks, but sometimes maybe they're viewing it too much through an American lens. So do you think, you know, with your understanding, do we understand the Russian mindset, you know, given the research that you've done, do we get it? I mean, you and Sam Bendit have done some great work in this area, a fantastic piece that was published last month. And what do you think about that mindset?
I feel like you maybe have been reading my notes. That's what I think. There's this clever saying, I can't remember where I first heard it, but it says, we don't see things the way they are, we see things the way we are. And I think that's just exactly what you said in terms of, you know, the American approach. And I see this a lot now, working in this technological innovation space and meeting with a lot of people from the military and the defense establishment writ large, who are working on competition in AI and just generally the technological advances that look into the competition with China and with Russia. And there's these like two separate voices on understanding innovation and technological competition within the broader strategic competition with Russia and China. There are people that look into like the Russian or Chinese innovation space, and specifically with Russia, effectively immediately dismiss it because nothing Russia does is very shiny or extremely new or especially complex or fundamentally innovative in a sense. Russia is not a competitor the way that China is a competitor to the United States in the technological space. And from the American perspective, innovation means being the first and being the best. And that is not the Russian approach to innovation. Being functional is already quite ambitious there. But that doesn't mean it doesn't work. And the second, so there are people that tend to kind of dismiss Russia because the stuff that it's doing is not like cutting edge or super cool. And then there's the second camp that kind of looks at China more so, but to Russia as well, with, I don't want to say like a jealousy, but some sort of like a romantic notion that because it's state-led innovation and state-led enterprise, and they're not as encumbered as the United States by things like, civil liberties or human rights or private sector, and those pesky things, they have the ability to just streamline collaboration between academia, private sector, military, government, and then they can allegedly be much more effective and efficient in what they produce and how they get there. But neither of those approaches actually is the right way to look at it, because what works for Russia and China works for Russia and China. It will not work for the United States. And what works for the United States, this idea of be first and be best, is not going to work for Russia or China because they do things differently. So I think we have to get much more serious about the cultures of innovation. First of all, understand our own culture and our own competitiveness there, as well as understanding others. And in that way, perhaps having regional experts, whether they are from the region or have, language capabilities or just cultural familiarity, is an absolute advantage and something that the United States should continue cultivating. But I would say that there is some sort of there's a lot of misperceptions.
So you mentioned that some of our competitors may not adhere to some of those pesky values that we have here in the U.S. So what do you think some of the biggest ethical and moral dilemmas are going to be in the future, not just for us, but maybe some of the other countries that don't adhere to our ethics? How do we stay with them? How do we compete with them, and what do we do from our side?
That's interesting. So I would not say that adhering to ethics is in any way something that undermines American ability to compete. I think it actually enhances American ability to compete, because being ethical, especially at a time of war, is a strategic advantage. Complying with humanitarian principles, with the laws of war, is a strategic advantage. Civil liberties, respect for private enterprise is a strategic advantage. There is still a very clear reason why America has been able to lead in the way that it has, because of all of those things. So it would be incorrect to think that our adherence to these principles is to our detriment. Quite the opposite. It's absolutely to our advantage. But at the same time, I would also say that, and again, this could be like a cultural misperception issue or just the stories that we tell ourselves kind of a thing. Just because Russia or China don't adhere to our conception and delineation of ethics, that does not mean that they can't or don't abide by certain rules of war and behaviors. Because a lot of those are in their self-interest. So I think it's important to pay attention to how they actually behave as opposed to how we think they would behave. So there's this perception that Russia is going to not really care, for example, about AI safety or AI security, and would rush innovation just to field systems faster. Perhaps. But at the same time, that could be to Russia's detriment, because what is the use of fielding systems that might not work, that might be much more prone to accidents, that might backfire and actually undermine what it is that they're trying to do? So just because they don't frame certain things in our terminologies does not mean that they don't have self-interest in self-preservation. So I think that helps to think about that. But to like the second part of your question, in terms of like what are the big ethical or moral conundrums in future warfare, I think there are probably three issues that concern me. One being the fact that, again, more and more conflicts are and will continue taking place in densely populated environments where more people live. So there's going to be a greater onus on abiding with these laws of war and conducting very careful and ethical warfare in environments where it's even much more harder to do so, just because of the intermingling between civilians and combatants. So that's one. The second one is because of, you know, the changing security environment and the resurgence of great power competition, I think we're going to see much more reliance and interactions with proxies, both for the United States and for, you know, its competitors, and working with proxies who don't necessarily share the same ethical and moral principles and guidelines and are not as careful in their conduct of war. I think there's questions to be asked there about where is our responsibility for our allies and for our proxies. And the third one is probably the fact that, you know, with continued and rapid innovation and autonomy and AI, we will be seeing greater delegation of responsibility from man to machine. And within that, there's a whole slew of, you know, moral and ethical dilemmas that we have to be aware of as well.
That's very interesting. I think really your second point regarding the proxies and everything else really ties into, previously we had Dr. Sean McFade on talking about the new rules of war. And I think that really relates highly to this idea of what kind of onus is put on that and how do we operate in this new space. So you've been really, with your background, with your research, you know, we've interacted a lot on LinkedIn and in all these spaces, and I've been following everything that you've done, and you've been really a critical female voice in a pretty male-dominated sector. So you're talking to future women about who will be researching in military studies and international affairs and security. What advice do you have for them?
My one piece of advice is that don't try to mold yourself in order to fit an environment where you will inevitably stand out. Like you said, I'm in a space where it's mostly male dominated. Usually I'm one of very few women in the room. There is nothing I can do to make myself look like anyone else in there. And taking into account that there's, you know, numerous studies and all of this research that shows that women are just evaluated differently. They're judged on such compelling metrics as their tone, what they wear, how they say the things they say. So before you even get to the work itself, you've been, you know, estimated and evaluated on 15 different things that, try as you will, you're not going to make everyone happy. So just, this is kind of trite, but be yourself and don't try to be something else. Yeah, and in the fact that you're different, in the fact that you stand out, be aware that you bring different perspectives, different experiences, different capabilities that overall make the collective better and stronger.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And really, as a follow-on, there's a lot of young women out there have really a lot of incredible talent. You know, just from your perspective, what can the military and the security complex as a whole, what can we do to empower those women more?
Let me answer this question on kind of two levels. I think we pay a lot of lip service to how people are our greatest asset and diversity is a strength. And then, you know, you scroll through Twitter or whatnot and you see these lists, these conference agendas that are all men, and these pictures from around the table at some very important decision-making environment where the only diversity you see is the color of the guy's ties. And it makes you wonder about whether we are actually making the systemic changes that need to be made in order to be more inclusive and to be more diverse. So maybe the security establishment doesn't work well with positives. Maybe it needs a negative. Maybe it needs to think about the fact that you don't have a diverse decision-making circle as a weakness, as a threat. If you are operating in this complex and complicated security environment where your competitors are serious people at this point, and you are coming to the table and everyone around that table kind of approaches these challenges that we're facing from the same perspective, you're doing yourself a disservice. And that reflects very poorly, I would say, on leadership. It undermines our readiness and undermines our agility, our ability to innovate, and to remain competitive in an environment that really demands it. So maybe, you know, positive motivators, like things would be better, don't work. Maybe we need to immediately now think that we are making things worse for ourselves by not acting. That's a shift in mindset, but a concrete shift is a very simple one. And I think anybody who is an expert in any field, who is, you know, approaching some sort of a mid-career level, if you get invited to a conference and you ask to see a list of who is there, and if you see that it's only dudes, don't go. Say, I'm not gonna go. Here are three names of experts who happen to be women. Invite them. Or say, I will go if you diversify your, you know, list of invitees. Or if you are in a position of power, in a position of leadership, and you're sitting around the table, have a moment, like a thoughtful moment of looking around and see if this is the best team of people to present a holistic, comprehensive solution, set of solutions to the problems that we're facing. Or are we all kind of thinking the same way? So I really just think that, like, again, people in positions of leadership need to be more conscious and more conscientious about who's in the room and what it means for the decisions that we're making and the approaches that we take to dealing with, like, the complex problems that we face today.
Thank you for that again. I mean, I think that's an important approach because we have a better chance of hedging against groupthink, and even the paradigms we talked about earlier of this Western American way of thinking that could seriously lead to some miscalculation or misunderstanding that we have, and we want to better understand that operational environment, what it looks like. So we have a couple questions we like to ask all our guests. So one fairly easy, and then a couple difficult ones. But what technology or trend really keeps you up at night? What worries you about the future?
I'm really interested to hear what sort of responses you're going to get on this one. I bet you're going to get people that go into, like, the nitty-gritty of the tech itself. I'm not going to be that person.
You don't have to. Go with whatever you think.
What really worries me and what keeps me up at night is our susceptibility to misinformation and how quickly, partially because of our susceptibility to misinformation, how quickly it spreads. And I think technology plays a huge role in that, both because of, like, our greater connectivity, but also with advances in things like deep fakes, things are only going to get worse. So we as a Western society in general, as Americans in specific, need to develop some sort of sets of, I don't know, resistance mechanisms and ability to better process and deal with information if we want to survive the next decades with technological advances. Yeah, so I would say it's the vulnerability to misinformation.
Yeah, I think that's significant. I think that's relevant. And I don't want to say it's overlooked, but I don't think it's being given maybe as much attention as it should.
The credence it probably deserves.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Rita, what's something about you that most people might not know?
For a very brief period of time, I was a nationally ranked ballroom dancer in Israel.
That is a fantastic fact, and probably will be used against you at certain DC galas.
Yeah, this is...
Matt and I are big cinephiles, and so we like to ask this one, and it's a hard one for people, but what's your favorite movie?
You're going to get a lot of interesting answers on that one, too, I bet. Well, for me, honestly, it's Mean Girls. And I'm going to tell you why. First, because it's an awesome movie. But second, because if you're like an international relations, national security, politics nerd, there's so much in there that just like is under the surface, but there's misinformation, there's information warfare, leadership decapitations, how to remove a dictator. And honestly, if you can find a better tactician than a suburban girl, I dare you.
Okay, so you guys heard that. You have to go watch Mean Girls so you can understand warfare and how we can win in the competition space in the future.
Exactly.
No, I really appreciate the honest answers, and this has been just such a great interview. What else would you want to say? Is there anything else you'd love to add?
I'm just very excited that you guys are doing this. I think you have such an important platform, and I read your writing and I follow your stuff all the time, and I think this is going to reach even a broader audience. So I'm excited you're having a diverse set of people come and talk to your listeners and bringing in different perspectives. So I'm very much looking forward to this, getting off the ground.
Dr. Konaev has some really, really great work she's done over the last couple of years. I follow it all the time. Where can they follow you at and see your work at?
I'm going to regret this. You can follow me on Twitter at Rita Konaev. I'm obviously also on LinkedIn. And on a much more serious and professional note, the place where I work, the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown University, has really an incredible team. And we've recently, within the last 4 months, have released a number of very meaningful reports that look into AI talent, about AI investment, a few ones on China. So if this is a space that you're interested in, absolutely follow CSET, subscribe to our newsletter, and we're also on Twitter and LinkedIn, and I have a project that looks into military applications of AI that's gonna be coming into fruition within the next half a year. So definitely stay up to date on that, because I think it's an increasingly important conversation that we should all be having.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been fantastic, and we've had a great conversation.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. You can follow us on Twitter at @ArmyMadSci. Be sure to subscribe to our blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madscciblog.tradoc.army.mil.